Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 31, Rhythm, Syncopation, and Much More, Poetry of Yusef Komunyakaa. This is your host, Monk, and I'm going to be reading a selection of poems by Yusef Komunyakaa, and going to end up with two YouTube segments of him reading his own poems. Has a distinct reading voice, wonderful cadence and accentuation, so it's a must to hear him read his own work. Messages I get from reading his poems is that you don't have to know exactly what all the poem means. You can ponder it or not, but there's the language and the imagery and the rhythm that, you know, it can be entertaining, intellectually stimulating, emotionally moving, however it hits you, and that sometimes trying to over understand or analyze poems gets in the way of just picking up a book and reading a poem or two here or there now and then is a real way to just stir yourself in a different way and refresh your connection with language. One of the first experiences I had hearing Komunyakaa was in the late 80s or early 90s. I saw him read, and it's interesting because I don't remember much of the reading itself, but the distinct image, he served in Vietnam, and a lot of his poems are about that, and I just have the distinct image of him writing a poem about a soldier sitting by the water or a bay or something mucky, and with his finger extended and curled like a cigarette ash. It's just something about that image has stayed with me all these years, so you never kind of know when you go to a theater or reading or something what's going to stay. One of my favorite anecdotes of when people ask, how do you know when a poem is really complete? Because it tends to be over the years one edits poems, and sometimes I look back on poems I wrote years ago, and it's like, oh my gosh, I thought that was great then, and now it needs some work. So I think it was on the Book Channel or somewhere I saw Komunyaka being interviewed, and they asked him, how do you know when a poem is done? And the anecdote he gave was that he had just had his complete, or at the time complete, poems published in Norton Anthology, which is kind of the top of the heap for literariness. And he said he was leafing through it, and he saw some changes he'd like to make. So I thought that was that's a great answer. A little background information, mostly here from Wikipedia. It says that Komunyaka is an American poet, teaches at New York University, and is a member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers. He's won numerous awards, including the 1994 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His subject matter ranges from the black general experience through rural Southern life before the Civil Rights time period and his experience as a soldier during the Vietnam War. He began writing poetry in 1973 at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs campus, where he was an editor for and a contributor to the campus arts and literature publication River Run. And that's when I was living in Colorado. That's why you must have heard him read then. His poetry, describing his poetry, his collection Copacetic fuses jazz rhythms and syncopation with hip colloquialism and the unique arresting poetic imagery which has since become his trademark. It also outlines an abiding desire in his work to articulate cultural truths that remain unspoken in daily discourse in the hope that they will bring a sort of redemption. And the line quoted, "How can love heal? The mouth shuts this way. Say something that resuscitates us behind the masks." And you could hear some birds chirping outside in the background. They like that bit. The masters of rhythm and syncopation themselves. A poem that's going to be played from the YouTube later called Facing It, in which the speaker of the poem visits the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. And at the end of the poem, he's lost his right arm inside the stone. In the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair. He's got numerous collections, including Taboo, the Wishbone Trilogy, Pleasure Dome, New and Collected Poems, Neon Binocular, Talking Dirty to the Gods, Magic City, and Thieves of Paradise. That's the book that I'm going to be reading some. The cover is William Penn, who, as far as I know the history, is probably one of the most friendly of the settlers with the natives. And the artwork is called Penn's Treaty with the Indians. And so that's part of the reason this was my choice of a book to get of his work. And interestingly, in the craft ways, it says, Komunyaka's work has been influential for a wide swath of current American poets. He views his own work as an indirectness, an insinuation. And then a quote, "Poetry is a kind of distilled insinuation. It's a way of expanding and talking around an idea or a question. Sometimes more actually gets said through such a technique than a full frontal assault." That's a fascinating statement because as much as directness is important in communication, there's something about the subtlety that, I suppose, it's hard to word, but reading a poem, and that's sort of what I meant by not always having to understand it, you can get a sense of images and a feeling, and sometimes there's just some lines that you connect with or drives home a point that moves you or changes you in a way, and I think that's my interpretation of what the indirectness or insinuation of his poetry does and what he means by it, which in a lot of ways is different from the full frontal assault of a lot of the hip-hop poetry, which has its place, but sometimes a bit much. So I'm going to sort of start with the book chronologically in a way, go forward. The first poem is Memory Cave. A tallow worked into a knot of raw hide, with a ball of waxy light tied to a stick. The boy scooted through a secret mouth of the cave. Pulled by the flambeau in his hand, he could see the gaze of agate eyes and wished for the forbidden plains of bison and wolf. Years from the fermented honey and musty air. In the dried slag of bear and bat guano, the initiate stood with sleeping gods at his feet, lost in the great cloud of their one breath. Their muzzles craved touch. How did they learn to close eyes, to see into the future? Before the before, Mammon was unnamed, and mist hugged ravines and hillocks. The elders would test him beyond doubt and blood. Micah lit the false skies where stalactite dripped perfection into granite. He fingered icon sunlight and anatase. Never touched. That's crystalline from titanium dioxide. And anatase never touched. Ibex carved on a throwing stick. Reindeer worried into an ivory amulet and a bear's head. Outside, the men waited 2 days for him with condor and bovid, and not in 1,000 years would he have dreamt a woman standing there beside a man saying, "This is as good as the stag at Salon Noir and the polka-dotted horses." The man scribbles, "Leo loves Angela," below the boy's last bear drawn with manganese dioxide and animal fat. This is where sunrise opened a door in stone when he was summoned to drink honey wine and embrace a woman beneath a 5-pointed star. Lying there beside the gods, hefty and silent as boulders, he could almost remember, before he was born, could see the cliff from which he'd fall. That's called Memory Cave, very evocative. And this is called Genealogy. We are almost unreal. If you don't believe me, let the wind open the journals of the House of Burgesses so you can hear it whisper lessons of the soil through maple and birch. We buried ourselves in holes, shelter we could wrestle free of earth and wood held in place by snow, this last door nailed shut with icicles. Rations dwindled to 8 ounces of meal and a pint of peas a day, working with maggots and cobwebs. That winter a man salted down guilt, feeding upon his wife till she was only a head. You can erase Sir Thomas Smith from your genealogical charts. Our ancestors stole handfuls of oats and were chained to trees, starved or broken slowly on the wheel. And here's our coat of arms, this crossbone, this boar, wreathed with hemlock and laurel. You can hear the syncopation, the rhythm, and his choice of words is just phenomenal. And he writes in a variety of styles, too. This is a longer poem. I'll read part of it. It's called Quatrains for Ishi. Ishi was the last member of the Yahi, a surviving group of the Yana people. In California, at the time claimed as the last wild Indian in America. So this is about him. And Ishi means man in the Yana language. When they swoop on you, hobbled there, almost naked, encircled by barking dogs, at daybreak beside a slaughterhouse in Oroville, outside Paradise, California, draped in a canvas scrap, matted with dung and grass seed, slack-jawed men aim rifles at your groin. Wild man hums through telegraph wires as women from miles around try to tame your tongue by cooking family recipes and bringing bowls of ambrosia to the jail. Hungry and sick, lonely and scared, you never touch the food. Not even the half-breeds can open your mouth with Wintu, Spanish, and Maidu. Days pass till an anthropologist faces you with his list of lost words, rolling them off his tongue like beads of old honey. But you are elsewhere, covering your head with a morning cap of pine pitch, in earshot of wild horse corral as wind steals prayers of the dead from Kingsley Cave. It takes more than years of moonlight to torch bones down to ashes to store in a rock cairn at Mill Creek. You are there, Ishi, with the last 5 men, strong enough to bend bows with the last 12 voices of your tribe. When you hear the anthropologist say, Sowini, the two of you dance and bang your hands against the wooden cot, running fingers along the grain of yellow pine. On Main Street, where gold fever left the air years ago, you're now the wild man of Oroville, beside a new friend. When the train whistles, you step behind a cottonwood shading the platform, form afraid of the demon your mother forbade you to venture near. What is it? Does a voice call to you out of a windy chaparral, out of Wawonopu Mutetna, to urge you back? Down that rainbow of metal light and sparks, then ferried across Carquinez Straits to the Oakland Mole, the Golden Gate frames water meeting sky as a trolley car lumbers uphill to your new home at the Museum of Anthropology. Here in this ancient dust, on artifacts pillaged from Egypt and Peru, I know why a man like you laughs with one hand over his mouth. Also, I know if I think of you as me, you'll disappear, Ishi. You're like a Don Juan sitting beside Mrs. Gifford calling birds. Who's Miss Fanny in this photo from St. Louis? Friend, what can you say about these stone charms from Lone Pine and England, and are you still going to Chico for that Fiesta Arborea? A little bit like some of the way that Tennessee Williams portrays a town, got some of that feel to follow up the poetic theme from last week. And this is a longer poem. Just going to read a section of it. It's called The Glass Ark. And as mentioned last week with Williams, this is a dialogue poem. It has a note before the poem. Two paleontologists working inside a glassed-in cubicle at La Brea Tar Pits. Each speaker is labeled M or W. M. How could you hear him when we were making love? W. Voices rise. M. Over lovemaking? W. Last week you said you loved how bird songs drifted into the bedroom. M. I didn't hear anything. W. I heard him say, please don't hurt me, Martin. M. I didn't hear anything but your love moans. W. I'm going to tell what I heard, every sigh, every plea, everything. M. Where would I be? W. Are you worried about your Miss What's-Her-Name? M. We hear things, we see things, we make the clavicle into an angel. W. A window's bottom sash swells with memories. M. Sometimes you can read salvation beneath sagebrush and cypress, but wonder how anyone ever dreamt these bones were their livestock that wandered off a blind path. W. Maybe if I were La Brea woman, nothing but a carbon-dated skull you can hold like a crystal ball and ask unfathomable questions, you'd count each seashell on my necklace 1,000 times. And he also has poems that are more in the free-flowing stream-of-consciousness kind of beat poet style, at least as they're laid out on the page in a paragraph form, whereas the others are so far more structured or very, very short lines on the page. And this one's called Shrines. A few night birds scissor dusk into silhouettes. Distant voices harmonize silences. Thatched houses squat against darkness and the squares of light grow through doorways like boxes inside boxes. They've driven ancestors deeper into the jungles, away from offerings of rice and children's laughter. There's no serpent to guard these new shrines. The cameraman has tried to make an amputee whole again, as if he can see through a lover's eyes. Everything's paralyzed at twilight except the ghostly jitterbug flicker of videos from Hong Kong, Thailand, and America, with spellbound faces in Hanoi, Haiphong, Quang Tri, wherever electricity goes. The abyss is under the index finger on the remote control. As if losing the gift of speech, they fall asleep into someone else's dream. And this is an interesting poem called A Story. She says he was telling a dirty joke about Asian women working in a sweatshop in Orange County, sewing Ku Klux Klan robes and hoods for the redneck discount somewhere in South Carolina as Mary Black sang Bright Blue Rose on the jukebox, when the whine of air brakes and raw squeal of Goodyear tires signaled the rig's thunderous crash through the sundowner's neon facade. That it's funny how no one else was hurt when the truck uprooted the big red bud out front and showered the whole day with flowers and bone. Yeah, those last lines are just something about sort of that inexplicable emotive feeling. Showered the whole day with flowers and bone. Explicable to me is the, is a kind of contrast of images that poets a lot of times use, something concrete and something abstract perhaps. Flowers and bone is a kind of unlikely combo. In the first poem, Memory Cave, that abstract and concrete is the elders would test him beyond doubt and blood. So the doubt is abstract and the blood is the concrete there. And that's an effective way to blend imagery, which perhaps gets at what, you know, a lot of the native poets and writers, people talk about how their language is poetry. And what Alan Watts talks about, how, you know, nouns and verbs are labels, and the floor is flooring and the house is housing. So, you know, when you say something like doubt and blood to our sort of English language interpretation, it's abstract and concrete, and yet in essence they do merge in a way that is a holistic language. And I think that's part of why a lot of people get turned off by poetry at school, because the teachers tend to overanalyze it and try to explain every darn thing, when a lot of times it's just a feeling you're going to get from those words, doubt and blood or flower and bone. There's a feeling that you're going to get, and you can explain it, which may help it, but the overanalysis can really be a turnoff, and not even the poets always know what the poem means. So again, I think part of why I'm reading these poems and accentuating the language and appreciation is hopefully that it'll stir some appreciation of language and what it evokes. All right, one more here to read, and then keeping it kind of simple this week, and gonna finish up with two of Yusef Komunyaka's poems off of YouTube, so you can hear how he sounds. This is called Strands. If you had asked after my fifth highball, as I listened to Miles's midnight trumpet in Venus de Milo's embrace, I would have nodded yes, as if I didn't own my tongue. Yes, I believe I am flesh and fidelity again. I washed lipstick off the teacup, faced your photo to the wall, swept up pieces of good time moshed with dust balls, and haggled with myself over a bar of lemon soap. Yes, I could now feel lux bile and desire sweetened by creamy chocolates, and I would have bet my Willie Mays cards a strand of your hair clinging to an old Thelonious t-shirt could never make me fall apart at this bedroom window beneath a blood-red moon. I had to read that a few times. I think he's talking about having parted with someone, or how the he was surprised at how much he was moved by knowing this person and this lover. The strand of hair could never make me fall apart at the bedroom window. That image seems to show how to convey that, and the poem being called Strands. This is the poem Facing It, about the Vietnam Memorial in D.C., and it starts off with a little introduction from Garrison Keillor.
Yusuf Komunyakaa is from Bogalusa, Louisiana, the grandson of Trinidadian stowaways. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994 for Neon Vernacular. He served in the U.S. Army in Vietnam.
And it took me about 14 years to write about my experiences in Vietnam. Facing it, my black face fades, hiding inside the black granite. I said, I wouldn't damn it, no tears. I'm stone and flesh. My clouded reflection eyes me like a bird of prey. The profile of night slanted against morning. I turn this way. The stone lets me go. I turn that way. I'm inside the Vietnam Veterans Memorial again, depending on the light to make a difference. I go down the 58,022 names, half expecting to find my own in letters like smoke. I touch the name Andrew Johnson. I see the booby trap's white flash, name shimmer on a woman's blouse. But when she walks away, the name's still on the wall. Wrist strokes flash, the red bird's wings cutting across my stare, the sky, a plane in the sky. A white rat's image floats closer to me, then his eyes look through mine. I'm a winter. He's lost his right arm inside the stone. In the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair.
Very evocative, and that last image of looking into the stone and realizing it's another, that's one of those moments of the kind of magic of poetry and a lot of how movies, dreamscapes, whatever it is that conveys that kind of image. The next poem is called Anodyne, A-N-O-D-Y-N-E, which dictionary says a medicine that relieves or allays pain. Anything that relieves distress or pain, the music was an anodyne to his grief. And that certainly, you could hear in that last poem, as he read the music, that it's almost like you could hear whatever jazz or bluesy music beat that infuses his poetry.
This is the last poem in the New and Collective Poems. New and Collective Poems entitled Pleasure Dome. The title of this poem is Anodyne. A love heart swells into a temple where it is held prisoner, where the god of blame resides. A love slopes and peaks the secret paths that make me selfish. I love my crooked feet, shaped by vanity and work shoes made to outlast belief, the hardness, cup and milk it can't fashion. I love the lips, salt and honeycomb on the tongue, the hair holding off rain and snow, the white moons on my fingernails. I love how everything begs blood into song and prayer. Inside an ache, a ghost hums through my bones like Pan's midnight flute shaping internal laws beside a troubled river. I love this body, made to weather the storm in the brain, raised out of the deep smell of fish and water hyacinth, held a rapture and the first regret. I love my big hands. I love it clear down to the soft, quick motor of each breath, the liver's 10 kinds of desire, and the kidneys lust for sugar. The skin, the sack of dung, enjoy the spleen, floating like a compass needle inside nighttime, always divining West Africa's dusty horizon. I love the birthmark, posed like a fighting cock on my right shoulder blade. I love this body, this solo, ragtime jubilee behind the left nipple, because I know I was born to wear out at least 100 angels.
beautiful poem there. Go out with two tracks from a CD called Heritage by Mamadou Diabaté. He plays the kora. The first track is, in the liner notes, it says, a grooving new arrangement of a classic song performed in the 1960s by the Instrumental Ensemble of Mali. Certainly a place in the world today that needs some peace and stability. The original words say, don't pretend you are the best if you are a hypocrite. The song was meant to inspire a positive attitude in the early days of Mali's independence. Mamadou used to play it with his father. And the second song is Sego Blues, an original composition by Mamadou using the Bambara pentatonic scale, which Mamadou notes is very close to the American blues scale. Sego was the capital of the 19th century Bambara Empire. The musicians stretch out with extended solos as they honor another aspect of Mali's rich multi-ethnic history. So, enjoy the music, and thanks so much for listening. Have a good one.